Hi, I'm Justin Tinsley. You might know me from my work at Anscape, or as the author of a Biggie Smalls biography, or from my mostly victorious appearances on Around the Horn. So you're going to be hearing different voices hosting ESPN Daily for the near future. And guess what? I'm one of them. I'll be pitching in for the rest of the week, helping this pod do what it's always done. Tell the best sports stories in audio day in and day out. Hope you enjoy. Today's episode contains graphic descriptions of intimate partner violence, sexual violence, and gun violence. Listener discretion is advised.
Police, what's your emergency?
This is Lauren. I'm dealing with a situation.
He was deceptive. He was dangerous.
Every woman I came across, I used my manipulation tactics to get what I wanted.
I think they're trying to lure me somewhere.
It's looking like this might be a kidnapping.
She said, no, 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 no. And I knew something was wrong.
I'm calling about my daughter, Lauren. The prosecutor's missing.
We're actively looking for her. We're doing everything we can to track her down.
The justice system failed her in so many different ways.
We have someone bleeding from the mouth and the ear in the car. We need an ambulance.
She did everything right, and nobody did anything from that point on.
Nicole Norn, we're here today to recount the story of Lauren McCluskey. She was a University of Utah heptathlete who was tragically murdered by her ex-boyfriend. And this is a story that reflects the sad reality that so many women in the college setting and beyond face, being failed by the very systems put in place to protect them.
Well, thanks for having me on to talk about it, Justin. We have been investigating this case for over 4 years. It was a big national story when Lauren was murdered in October 2018. And we were watching it, but we really wanted to just step back and look at the bigger picture of this tragedy. How did it happen? And was it preventable?
So for anyone listening, putting this into context, for a journalist, you take 4 years working on a story. That's a long time. What exactly were you looking to find?
We were really looking to uncover a lot of the material that was in the police report. Surveillance videos, police interviews, photographs in the evidence file. Documents. More importantly, though, we really wanted to talk to people that had never spoken before. A lot of the focus had been on the University of Utah and the failures that happened there, both with campus police and the housing department. But we knew that the failures were larger than that. And we wanted to look at the entire state and the criminal justice system. So we wanted to look at the parole board. We wanted to speak to police involved. And we were in communications with the university throughout. They ended up not giving us anyone on camera, but they did give some really interesting quotes that we were able to include in both the documentary and our written story on ESPN.com.
You know, this is the most frustrating part of this, because in a lot of ways, you could argue that this story and even this interview that we're having right now, there should have never been a need for it. Like, our paths should not have crossed in this manner, Nicole. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, sadly, that is right. Yeah, her death was absolutely preventable. In December 2018, then-president Ruth Watkins of the University of Utah, they were announcing the results of a university-commissioned independent investigation. And she was quoted at that press conference saying the report showed that Lauren's death wasn't preventable.
This report does not offer us a reason to believe that this tragedy could have been prevented.
That is what prompted the McCluskeys to perk up and pay attention. Jill says very memorably in the documentary, it made her sick to her stomach to hear the president say that.
I was shocked that she would say that. I just felt sick to my stomach.
It actually, to be honest, I think it made all the journalists covering this story take a bigger interest as well, because it didn't seem to line up. Those words didn't seem to match with the results of that investigation. So I think a lot of people involved watching this were wondering, like, why would the school say that? And as a news director in our documentary says, it became clear that there was a lot of stuff going on with trying to protect the image of the university.
There was one question that overshadowed all others when University of Utah student Lauren McCluskey was murdered on campus by her ex-boyfriend. How could this have happened? Her friends had shared their fears with campus housing. Both Lauren and her parents had reached out to campus security. Lauren went so far as to contact Salt Lake City Police. So today, Nicole Noren tells us the story of how every system put in place to protect Lauren McCluskey failed. I'm Justin Tinsley. It's Thursday, March 30th. This is ESPN Daily. You know, Nicole, like the one thing that binds us all is that we're all going to have two dates on our tombstone, right? Regardless of gender, regardless of race, sexual orientation, ethnicity, religion, the day we got here and the day we left will all be on our tombstone. But there's a powerful story that lives in the dash in between those two dates. That dash tells our entire life story, who we are, the legacy we created, and what we hopefully gave to the world. So can you tell us a little bit about Lauren McCluskey's dash and how exactly she ended up at the University of Utah?
Yeah, Lauren was born in Berkeley. Her parents, Jill and Matt, are academics, and they soon moved to Pullman, Washington. Jill was recruited to come to Washington State, and Matt came along with her. So Lauren grew up in a family that where education was highly prioritized, and she was a shy child, but then started really getting into sports. And her parents said that that really drew her out and made her more had a lot more confidence.
She was a very sensitive girl, and so the athletics really gave her a way to channel that. It just helped her be a more confident person.
She was very driven in the classroom, and then she fell into track.
I put her in three events at 8 years old, and she broke the record for each event. 400, high jump, and long jump.
Jill at one point told her when she was, I believe, about 8 years old, that if she did well in a regional meet, that she would take her to nationals. At one point, she was competing with anyone on the national stage when she was a youngster. Lauren was also creative. She was really into music. She was a great singer. You'll actually hear her singing in our documentary to open the doc.
You know I'm not one to break promises. I don't want to hurt you, but I need to breathe. At the end of it all, you're still my best friend. But there's something inside that I need to release.
And her friends tell us that she was so loyal to them. She really was very genuine and was always there for them if they needed her. She ended up doing well in high school. And then after being recruited by the many track teams, she ended up picking the University of Utah. She wanted to go a little bit and experience college away from home. And she also really liked the academics there as well as the solid Pac-12 track and field team. And as her parents told us, she was very happy to go to school there.
The University of Utah, she really loved the athletic program. She liked the academics.
She liked the coaches. She liked the girls on the team. She just enjoyed the whole experience.
So as an 18, 19-year-old, you graduate high school, you leave college for the first time, and you really hope that you make the right decision in terms of where you want to continue your academic career, but where you really want to continue the evolution of your life. And it feels like this is exactly where Lauren was supposed to be. So what exactly did you learn about her life as a student athlete at the University of Utah?
Well, from her family and friends, they told us that Lauren was very intensely focused on her athletics, but more so probably on her schoolwork. When she was moving along throughout her career there, she ended up gravitating towards just spending more time in her life away from athletics. Lauren typically rose early. She'd attend a morning like workout, go to class, and then go back for afternoon practice. And then she would go and study. She wasn't a huge partier, but she definitely liked to go out and dance. But as she came closer to graduating, her world started opening up more and she concentrated less on sports. She was more into singing and comedy than her athletics. So her track career somewhat fell a little bit short, I think, of her initial expectations, but she just had an evolution there and started looking forward to life after graduating from the University of Utah. She was looking forward to, her dad told us, she was really looking forward to going perhaps to somewhere warmer like San Diego and maybe getting into communications or a job like that.
That's the story of most college athletes, right? Like, most don't go on to become Olympians or first round draft picks or even second, third round draft picks. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Now, for anyone listening, I strongly encourage you to pay attention to the timeline we're about to embark on. You're about to hear just how much happened in such a short amount of time, 51 days to be exact. So, Nicole, take me to where the heart of your reporting began. It's around September 1st, 2018. She's starting her senior year, as you just said, about to start the rest of her life, really. So what happens here?
The semester had just started. It was September 1st, a Saturday night in Salt Lake City. She went out dancing with her freshman roommate and close friend, Alex. They went to a bar in downtown Salt Lake. And outside of that bar, there was a bouncer. And Alex told us how he came around them and basically started pursuing Lauren that night.
I remember him being very huge, very big muscles. Throughout the night, he would come back and pass through and stop and talk to us a few times.
His name was Sean Fields, or he says it was Sean Fields.
He said his name was Sean. He was 28 years old. He was enrolled currently at Salt Lake Community College.
Alex said he seemed genuine, he seemed earnest, that he seemed very confident. She also said that Lauren was not acting herself around him. It was a part mix of being a little bit shy, but also brazen.
Probably around midnight, we got up to leave. It was very crowded because people were dancing at this point. I was behind her, and then all of a sudden, I look up, and then he has, like, his hands on her shoulders. So she gave him her number, and they made plans to go on a date later that day.
And Alex remembers thinking, I can't believe you did that. But they ended up going on a date later that day. Lauren told her mother very soon after about that first date.
He took her out for dinner and bought her flowers and asked her to be his girlfriend. I think she liked the attention. He was very charming.
But as you reported in the piece, Nicole, people in Lauren's circle, they started to notice some red flags almost immediately.
Yeah, her friends started noticing some red flags pretty early. Within a few days from meeting at that bar, Alex told us that she remembers Lauren saying, Sean said, you could come with us and come out.
She said, Sean said I could invite a few friends to go out on Thursday and meet him. But I found it weird how she phrased it. He said I could invite.
And she was talking about what he wanted her to wear or not to wear.
She said he told me to wear a t-shirt and jeans, so that's why I'm wearing this.
And Alex really perked up and thought this was not normal of her friend to be listening to a guy telling her, you know, what to do or what to wear. Felt like there was a level of control that she was noticing already. Soon after this, they were in Target shopping and he called her and it was on speaker so Alex could hear. And he was peppering her with questions. Where are you? Who are you with?
And she seemed very nervous around him. He called her while we were at Target. He sounded very mad, like, where are you? Who are you with? And I found that very concerning.
But what really caused her friend's serious concern is when she told them he wanted to take her shooting and wanted to get her a gun.
He got her pepper spray at one point. He's like, oh, I think you need pepper spray to protect yourself from other men. Then he invited her to go shooting. Before she went, she told me he wants me to get a gun.
This was not like Lauren at all. Her friends and family have told us it was very abnormal for her to even consider that. And that is when her friends took their concerns to their friend, who happened to also be an on-site graduate housing advisor, Diamond Jackson.
They started outlining, Lauren's seeing this new guy. He's not really a good guy. She's not hanging out with us as much. And he's talking about getting her a gun. And then that's when, you know, it had passed the point of, oh, this is harmless gossip to, this is actually something that could be detrimental to, you know, her academic career. And then I had to switch into professional mode.
This is now early October 2018. It was fall break at the University of Utah. So, Nicole, what happened with Lauren then?
Well, Lauren went home to Pullman, Washington for a fall break. So it was a long weekend. And that is right about the time when she started becoming suspicious about Sean's identity, because she saw an ID of his, a state ID, that had a different date of birth and a different name. And it said Melvin Sean Roland. So she became confused and concerned and worried. And she went home for the fall break. She met up with her high school best friend, Regina Snyder. They went to a restaurant and were catching up. And then Lauren told her that, I think I'm dating someone who might not be who he says he is. And they scrolled through Lauren's phone and they were searching for answers. Sean Fields wasn't easy to find because he didn't have any social media presence. Somehow she did like a reverse Google image search, and the name in the photo of Melvin Sean Roland popped up. The photo looked like someone who was on a sex offender registry, and he had been convicted of two sex crimes. He wasn't 28, and he was 37 years old.
This has to be life-altering for her, right? Like, everything you knew about a person was a lie. A dangerous lie at that. So what exactly did she do with this information?
So Lauren decided she needed to break up with him. This had only been a little more than a month after they had been dating. It was a very new relationship, but she already realized all this information and she knew that she needed to end it. So on October 9th, she met him and he came to her dorm. She broke up with him, but in order to defuse the situation, she went ahead and let him borrow her car.
Okay. Now they're broken up, so the story should be over right now, but it's not, because he's still in contact with her because, like you just said, he still has her car. So how exactly was she able to resolve that?
Well, her mother got involved and called the campus police and told them she was worried.
University Police Cash Security, how can I help you?
Hi, I would like to request some help from my daughter, who's a student at University of Utah, and she started dating this guy there who's like a bad person.
Okay.
And she found out he's a bad person and she broke up with him and he has her car.
Yep.
He was lying to her.
Okay.
And he's actually a sexual offender. I don't want her to go there by herself and have something bad happen to her.
The police dispatch then called Lauren, and the security there did escort and help Lauren. You can hear her for the first time in the audio though, and you hear the trepidation and hesitation in her voice at this entire situation.
Hello?
Hi, is this Lauren?
Yeah.
Hi, this is University Police. Your ex-boyfriend's dropping off your car. Do you feel comfortable with him doing that? I know your mom was really concerned about it.
I think it's okay.
We have a security officer that's just in charge of escorts tonight. Do you want him to wait with you as well when the car's getting dropped off?
That would be great.
Now, this should have been the end of the story, right? She broke up with him. She got her car back. But it's not the end of the story. In a lot of ways, it's kind of the beginning. So what happened to Lauren next?
She started getting a series of very odd text messages. She thought some were from Melvin Roland, but some were from his friends, supposedly. It was all very confusing. There were numbers that she didn't recognize. She didn't realize that he was actually the one sending all of them at the time. She thought it was multiple people. After receiving so many of these threatening and bizarre texts, she decided that she needed to contact the police.
I've been getting these texts about from these numbers of different people. They were saying that he was in the hospital and then saying that, like, that he passed away. But then I got a text from him, and he seems to be alive. I got a text about, you know, asking if I wanted to go to a funeral, his funeral. And I think they're trying to lure me somewhere.
Wow. Okay. So now she's getting these texts and she's alerting the proper authorities about this. So how exactly did the police respond to this?
Well, they didn't respond initially. They were supposed to call her back, but they didn't. And then the next day, it was a Saturday, October 13th, Lauren called them again because she got a text saying that some nude photos of her and Roland were going to be put on the internet.
So I'm dealing with a situation where I'm being blackmailed for money. A photo of me and my ex, they're threatening to send it out to everyone.
So after track practice that day, Lauren and Alex, her friend, went in person to the University of Utah Police Department to file an official report and to talk to the officers. And as Alex told us, Lauren felt good. She felt like she'd given the report, the police were going to take over, and she would put an end to this situation. But little did she and everyone else know that she would only have 9 days left to live.
Coming up, how failure after failure after failure of so many led to the death of Lauren McCluskey. All right, Nicole, so we left off talking about the University of Utah Police Department, but I kind of want to go back a little and check in on some of these other safety nets that clearly failed Lauren. So what else can you tell me about the housing department?
Yeah, so Diamond Jackson, the graduate housing advisor who had heard the complaints from Lauren's friends, she sent an email to her supervisors listing all the concerns that her friends had voiced, and she moved that up the chain of command. Because of the timing of the fall break and just some other things that were happening, the housing department never officially had a meeting where they chatted about Lauren's situation. And what we found out actually through our reporting is that there wasn't the best relationship between housing and the police, and the contentious relationship between those two entities was perhaps a factor in this as well. The people in authority just failed to act or recognize the severity of the concerns.
Okay, so Nicole, my next question deals with Melvin Sean Roland, because this has been burning a hole in my mind throughout this whole interview. Roland was a convicted sex offender, but he was back in the world and free to date women. How did the system fall apart here?
Well, his initial convictions were quite a while before he met Lauren. In 2003 is when he was a student at the University of Utah, and that's when he initially was arrested and charged with two felonies. One was the rape of a 17-year-old high school student, and the other was enticing a minor over the internet charges, where he had attempted to have sex with who he thought was a 13-year-old. He ended up accepting a plea deal later and was convicted of lesser charges in 2004 and went to prison. His recommended sentence was 1 to 15 years, and he could have got out sooner, but he ended up not fulfilling some of his sex offender therapy obligations. There's a parole board hearing in 2012 where they discussed that with him and how he didn't fulfill his therapy. And at that 2012 parole hearing, he did something that shocked everyone.
I'd like you to give me kind of a idea of what we're looking at victim-wise.
I would say every female that I came across dating or met on the internet, I'd say every woman I've met or that came across, that I used my manipulation tactics to get what I wanted.
Mm-hmm. How many did you out and out rape, like the one young lady?
Like, not like that, but me being a womanizer, you know, I use other taxes to get what I wanted with them. I'd say some similar, so I'd say two.
Two others?
Okay, Nicole, I'm struggling here. I'm struggling. How is confessing to such an alarming pattern of behavior not enough to warrant an arrest on the spot?
Well, we asked the Utah Board of Pardons and Parole that question. And they told us that while these hearings are under oath, the prisoners are not read their Miranda rights. So under the Fifth Amendment and the right of self-incrimination, they are protected.
So basically, he was out on a technicality, right?
He ended up getting out of prison soon after that hearing. But then within a few months, he was back. He did get out then and was out for a few years and fathered a son. When we pick up with him is he is about to get out in April 2018 before this whole story kind of set its course. And that's when we pick up with him. We talked to his parole agent, Megan Thompson, who was his last parole agent. And she was assigned to his case at that time when he got out in the spring of 2018. He had a couple jobs then. And in addition to being a bouncer, he worked at a call center for General Dynamics Information Technology.
And so now we're at his time at General Dynamics Information Technology. And that brings us back to the present. Because at this time, Lauren, she's still waiting for the police to follow through on that report that she filed on October 13th. But at the same time, Melvin is sharing his situation with his supervisor, right?
Correct. We now know that a few days after Lauren's murder, that supervisor and some of his coworkers were interviewed by the campus police. We are able to find out that he was aware of her movements because he had access to her email, so he could see her correspondence with the police. So he was telling his supervisor and coworkers exactly what he had done. He pulled out his phone and showed them the statutes that he believed he had violated. And he told them he had likely violated his parole and would be most likely going back to prison.
Let's get back to Lauren, because when we left off with her, it was Saturday, October 13th. She and a friend were heading to the campus police to file a police report. They filed that police report. So what happens from there?
So she initially filed the report with an officer named Miguel Darris. Another officer named Aaron Nelson was there helping. And they were able to sit with Lauren and her friend Alex there. We see this all unfold in a surveillance video that we acquired. They looked into Roland's background, didn't see he was on parole, and the case wasn't prioritized right away. There was an on-call detective that day named Kayla Daloff. She wasn't in the office, though, but they were in communication with her. She gave them instructions of how they should take the evidence and suggested that they have Lauren send the screen grabs that were sent to her, the photos, and start collecting the evidence so she could pick it up when she was back in the office on Tuesday, which would have been 3 days later. But most importantly, after all of the interactions at the police station, no one ever reached out to Melvin Roland to question him.
It's just, I can't even compute that. That doesn't make sense in what you're saying. But for now, I want to go back to that awful night, the one with Lauren's mother, hearing her daughter's last words be no, 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 and the phone disconnected. So what happened from there?
Well, according to the police report, we know that Roland grabbed Lauren as she was about to enter her dorm and use her key card to go in. He dragged her to a nearby parking lot and pushed her into the back seat of a silver Buick he had borrowed from his neighbor. We spoke with the officer who was one of the first ones there on the scene, and quite a bit of time went by before they realized that she had been in this car. The car was parked directly next to her own vehicle. And the officer, he spoke to us on the condition his name not be used, but he opened the passenger side door and saw Lauren. She had been shot 7 times, and he checked her neck for a pulse, and there was none.
As if this story couldn't get any more heartbreaking, any more depressing, any more infuriating, what exactly did Melvin Roland do after killing Lauren McCluskey?
We can actually see him on surveillance video as he escapes from that parking lot. He went across a bridge and he ended up at a light rail station on campus. Then he was picked up in a silver car. And we now know it was a woman who picked him up, who he had arranged a date with on a dating app. He went to sushi with her. And then he went to her apartment and asked her if he could take a shower. He had said he had worked out and wanted to take a shower. But after he left, the woman saw his photo on the news and she called the police. A short time after he ended his date, police saw a suspect matching Roland's description.
Around 1 a.m., Salt Lake City police officers spotted him in the area of 200 East and 500 South downtown.
They were chasing him on foot, and they chased him to this location where they found that he had forced entry to this building.
We have your suspect inside the church. It looks like he has a gunshot wound self-inflicted.
So in spite of all the warnings, all the pleas for help, Lauren loses her life tragically. So how quickly did any of the other entities involved, and I'm talking the school, the campus police, the housing department, take responsibility for this?
Initially, the university deflected quite a bit of responsibility, but a report was commissioned by them. And then 2 months later, President Ruth Watkins made a now infamous statement at that news conference.
This report does not offer us a reason to believe that this tragedy could have been prevented.
But as time went on and more people started digging into what really had happened, other groups started taking more responsibility, like university campus police, housing department, and it seemed to point blame towards lack of training and coordination and communication and privacy issue, among other excuses.
So I got to ask you this, Nicole, like, what about Lauren's parents? Were they able to find answers, and were they able to find some slight semblance of closure?
Well, there was one thing that Matt and Jill McCluskey were not interested in doing, and they didn't want to sue the university. They were hoping that the school would willingly give them all the information that they wanted. The relationship started to change, though, and the only ability they had to get the full answers was to file a lawsuit. They filed a $56 million lawsuit against the school, and that helped shake some things loose. It took some time, and they eventually settled. On the two-year anniversary of Lauren's murder, the school settled for $13.5 million. And as her parents have said, not a dime of that is going to them. They've set it aside to all be for a new foundation they established called the Lauren McCluskey Foundation. The main initiative of their foundation is something called Lauren's Promise.
Lauren's Promise is, I will listen and believe you if someone is threatening you.
And we just continue to get more and more schools and faculty members to sign up for that. I think we have about 200 schools all over the world. We have promised that we donate all the funds from the lawsuit, and most of it is going to the foundation.
I think people really remember her and want to honor her memory as much as possible, not only how she died, but how she lived.
As we bring all of this to a close, Nicole, I got to ask you this, like, what have you learned from the last 4 years?
Well, I've learned just how quickly something can go very wrong in a relationship. I mean, Lauren, through the course of 51 days from when she met him to her death on October 22nd, 2018, the main takeaway that I've had from this is just the seriousness that needs to be given to people when they bravely come forward and report troubling situations. It's also really important to remember that this isn't a problem unique to the University of Utah. This is happening all over. Although we are able to shine a bright light onto what happened at this certain school, it's sadly going on at other places. Many people have been very affected by this case, in addition to obviously Lauren's own family and friends who are forever changed by it.
So Nicole, as for the university itself, is there any indication that they've learned from this and they're growing from this?
Well, there are some very encouraging signs that they are. The campus police department has been overhauled. There are many systems in place now to take reports of potential violence more seriously. And we can report that even as of last Friday, March 24th, the University of Utah announced that they plan to hold a series of listening sessions about Lauren's murder in response to our documentary. But something that I'd like to add is that although Lauren's murder happened in 2018 and many steps were taken to improve the situation, last year there was another University of Utah student murdered. The breakdowns in her case happened with the housing department, and the school recently came to terms on a $5 million settlement with that student's parents. She is an international student named Zai Fundong, And the breakdowns that the school discussed in the settlement are sadly some of the same ones that Lauren experienced. So hopefully people are learning. Hopefully they will not make these same mistakes and that they'll truly listen and act when students come forward seeking help.
Nicole, thank you so much for your time and telling this story. I know it was hard, but it was necessary. And then I hope a lot of people take a lot of things away from this.
Thank you so much, Justin. I really appreciate being able to share Lauren's story.
The Lauren McCluskey documentary, Listen, reported by Nicole Noren and TJ Quinn, is available now on ESPN+. And an accompanying written feature is currently available on ESPN.com. I encourage you to check out both. I'm Justin Tinsley. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.